Commission Metro Plan for Energy in the Western Cape. I will then allow for questions and answers. I will then open up a second round of questions and answers after that. If you just give all the officials in the room after for the record and the letter. Thank you.
I'm Jan de Vosse, Eskom, Chief Operating Officer.
Good morning, my name is Albert Eskom, the General Manager for Eskom in the Western Cape.
Good morning, I'm Sarah Clark, I'm from the Energy Security Game Changer.
Good morning, my name is Jeff Trickham, I'm from the Department of Economic Development, I'm the Energy Director in the Green Economy.
Good morning, Helen Daly, Chief Director of the Green Economy in the Department of Economic Development and Insurance.
Good morning, my name is Sorrell. I'm on the Energy Security Game Changer in the Economic Development and Tourism.
Good
morning, my name is Amir Swanadeshwar, I'm a member of the committee.
Okay, I'm Ola Dale Mitchell, let's hand you from here.
If our guest at the back wants to just introduce himself to the record, please.
Good morning, I'm Ritumelo Mohale. I'm with PMG.
Good morning, I'm Lucky, DA researcher.
Good morning, I'm Manasa Ninopoulos from the Metro City Center and the Metro Newspaper.
Thank you. I'm
not sure if
any other apologies and to all
Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you for being here for a lot of and depending on the type of relationship we have with it, it could be
how will this campaign start on behalf of that customer? But this is just basically the enrichment capacity that we have in this company. I know this is a bit small, so let me apologize again, but these following slides that you see is really just an indication of what investments we're making in which areas of the province and which categories we're making those investments, whether it be permissions, reliability, and other customers, etc. So I tried in the yellow block to summarize some of the areas. If you look at the Ashton area, we're investing in the Ashton area about 39 million. In the Blue Lines area, we're investing about 64 million. In Theories, we're doing 7 million. George, 79, and our work, 21 million. And then the makeup of those is in the actual table that you see. And these are little previews as well. So our investment plans for our capital investment plan is a 3 to 5 year plan that we look at. So what we plan to do in the 5 years, but we do adjust it annually. Again, summarized in the whole area, 61 million plan investment. In the Peru, 6 million. Kailicha, 66 million. Maurizburg area, 123 million. And in Oaksville, about 60 million. In the whole prospect yield environment, we have to spend about 700 million over the next 5 years. And then again, planning to look at the Worcester area, Stiphout, Freya, and Kierendal, and that's the proportion of the project that we plan to spend over the next few years. So before I get to the maintenance plan, let me just give an indication. We spend about 250 to 300 million on capital annually in the province, on projects, and that excludes other customer projects. So those are refurbishment and reliability projects in the province. Now this is significantly less than what we used to spend in the past. In the past in this province, we would spend about 500 million. And that is based on our capacity and our ability to execute. But I think we're already conscious of the constraints that this demonstrates. So what we've tried to do across the country, not only in this province, is to prioritize the projects in the province. And what we do is we engage with the stakeholders and we look at which projects are actually critical for them and which projects in particular will drive economic growth in the province, and we try to focus on those. So when we used to have networks where we could afford to spend additional capital and create the redundancy in them, N-1, N-2 levels, we've actually taken those out of the system and said, well, let's always look at the opportunities that create economic growth. And if we only think to have 300 million for this year, we need to put that 300 million. So it has been driven by those facts. We see ourselves spending between 200 and 300 million for the next 3 years. And it's only in year 4 that we start to see a kick in the capital again, and we push up to about 250 million in this province in 2020. The second part of the network plan for the province is the maintenance component. Now it's quite critical to understand because if you're spending less money on capital, it becomes quite important for you to make sure that the existing equipment is properly maintained. And so the maintenance regime is also quite critical here. Again, this is just the definition of what we have in place in terms of assets and how we define assets and how we maintain those assets. So when we talk about substations, we tend to be talking about the primary farm, secondary farm, that include for those offences that lead to those substations, those are considered to be part of that substation. When we talk about sub-transmission, we're talking about anything greater than 44 kV, and that's really underground cable. So we are one of two provinces in this country where cable is in fact we have quite a bit of cable as opposed to overhead line. Ourselves in South Thames have got the most cable in the country, underground cable, that is. And again, the same as we have for capital, we have different categories of maintenance. So you talk about things like vegetation maintenance, pole replacement projects, low voltage maintenance, major maintenance. And then I've tried to highlight about more preventive maintenance. And this is really quite critical because this is the one that, if it's done properly, really gives you reliable supply.
in total over the next 2 years, our maintenance budget that we're looking at is just over 410 million. And we've just hit half year of the first year of our maintenance cycle, and today we spent about, I can check yesterday, we're on about 95 million at the moment in terms of actual spend. So we're fairly on track in terms of our plan in terms of the maintenance spending for the next 2 years. This is just the allocation for the maintenance for the different sectors. And so we determine sectors in terms of our network layout. So what we call sector one covers areas such as Bundar, the Kalapan City, Mountain View, and the Wushu. So very much the Borland area, if you were to look at it, that would be the Borland area. And you can see we've allocated over the next 2 years just over 7.6 million for maintenance. And then closer to home in terms of your Porcupine, your Dal area, Somerset West Triton plan, about 6.7 million. Then closer to the West Coast side, Cape Town, Mountain, Flinders, Flinders, Dal, 8.1 million. And then if you look at the Southern Cape side of the province, George, Cape, the River Valley, Smith, just under 10 million. And then for the Krabowe, Mabisi, Spine area, we set aside about just over 8 million. So these are just the different categories of maintenance that we're setting. So if you look at the first one, which is major maintenance, and then you can see under liability maintenance, we set aside similar types of budgets for those areas as well. Chair, one of the questions that was asked is, what is the plant performance like in this province? So the really technical indicators of plant performance are really two matrices or indices that we look at the best. The first one is called spiral, and that is really the duration of interruptions that customers experience. So the definition actually says the standard average incident duration index. So that is how long is the customer out for. So that would be the one metric. The second metric is how frequently is that customer out. So just to give the committee a view over the last 5 years, so when we talk about duration, our customers in this province have experienced, on average, from 14 or 15 hours of outage per annum up to about 20 hours per annum, okay, over 5 years, at any one time. And if you look at the society chain, and that is the frequency. In 2014, customers in this province experienced on average 7 incidents a year. And if you look at 2019, again, we're back to 7 incidents per year. Now, just to give this some perspective, in the rest of the country, customers experience outage durations of about 30 to 35 hours. So customers are out to do that. And they experience roughly about 20 incidents per year. So for the last 5, and I almost want to say for the last 10 years, the Western Cape customers have experienced lower number of incidents for much shorter periods than the rest of the country. I think to give you a broader perspective, we've done benchmark exercise for this province, and we try to compare ourselves to other countries that have similar networks, similar population as the Western Cape, and a similar economic outlook as the Western Cape. And we find ourselves in the top quartile of countries in terms of performance for plant technical performance. So our customers experience at this point the least number of outages for the shortest possible period in the province. Chips on the renewable energy side. What has happened over the Bidjar share is that we've seen a significant amount of decisions taken in terms of renewable energy, both on wind and on solar. So on the wind side, already installed in the Western Cape, we've got just over 390 megawatts of wind installed in the Cape and about 133 megawatts of solar installed in the Cape.
because the ISKCON is a national group, all capacity is managed nationally in the context of the regional group. So all renewable energy is dispatched from our system operator nationally, and it's not dispatched at the regional group. So if you have to aggregate and take the total amount of renewable energy in the country, of the peak system operator will then utilize everything available in terms of renewable energy and dispatch that into the system. The other important thing also to note is that where a power station is located is not necessarily the area that they service. So Kubrick, although situated in the Cape, does not service the Cape. It actually services the national grid. So energy is sent to the national grid and is then redistributed across the provinces depending upon the need that's required. So Chief, what you see on the right hand side, the plan, those are still in the bid round that have not been approved yet. But we have got an idea of what capacity, if approved, we will be able to install in the province over the next 2 to 3 years. Chief, one of the things that we've undertaken in our relationship with the World Bank is a project called the Battery Energy Storage System, BESS project. It was part of the conditions of the loan that ISKCON took, that we would actually drive renewable energy part of the business as well. The initial stages in 2010 when we took the loan, the agreement was that we would implement 100 megawatts and it was going to be concentrated solar or CSP. However, when we started the investigation into that, we found that it would be too difficult for us to actually implement this project in the timeline provided by the World Bank. We then renegotiated with the World Bank, went back to them with an alternative option, and they accepted the alternative option, which is really for us to put together a battery storage alternative, and we'll be able to roll that out, or the pilot will have to be rolled out by 2021. So what we've done in ESKCON thus far, Chair, is we've identified the projects, we've broken it up into phases. Phase 1 will complete at the end of December next year. And that phase 1 is also broken up even further into a pilot, which has got 2 projects in it, and then the balance of it, which we will have done by 2022. So just in terms of the process we followed, and I have to also indicate that the process in the World Bank is not 100% aligned with the National Treasury process, so a lot of discussion between ourselves, National Treasury, to look at what is allowed and what's not allowed in terms of our operations with ESKCON. But the contract that we're going for is what we call the EPCM, which is Engineer Procure Construct and Maintain option. And what we've agreed to with the World Bank is that whoever the successful vendor is, that they will have a 5-year maintenance window, and in that 5-year maintenance window, that ESKCON will then have the opportunity in the 5 years to transfer the skills, so after the 5 years we'll then start to maintain these plants ourselves. That's a new technology, so we don't in ESKCON have the capacity at this point to actually build or maintain battery storage. And we're not talking about small battery storage, we're talking about utility size battery storage, so just relatively in terms of size, if you look at your backup to the computer, the size of that little box, these things we're talking about are the size of shipping containers, and multiple ones of those will actually be on site. Change is an indication of which projects actually occur in which phases. There are 2 pilots that we're running, one in the Eastern Cape called Malco, and then the one closer to us in the Western Cape Southwest, which is really on the same site as our CBD farm. We chose that specifically because we already had the EIA in place for that and met the requirements of the World Bank, which means we could deliver this pilot quite quickly for them. The size of the project for the Western Cape is a 50 megawatt project. So we have 50 megawatts on battery storage available as at the end of December 2020. But as you can see, Chair, in the Western Cape, in phase 1, we've actually got a significant amount of projects. We've got X, we've also got Palladium, which will deliver an additional almost 40 megawatts in terms of battery storage. Then also in phase 1, we've got what we call Middleton and Middleton. just back in context check. If we have a total budget of 300 million for capital, it's really difficult for us to spend two-thirds of that on one project for any municipality. So the alternative to that was, in fact, to come up with a renewable energy option. What battery storage is the most likely, and that will definitely offer us an opportunity to improve the economy of the Luxembourg area by being battery storage. So this is quite a critical project for us. In phase two, again, here you will see the bulk of the projects is in the Western Cape. You find that 75% of the greatest pilot of the greatest project that you all back has approved actually sits in the Western Cape region. And there's good reason for that. The first is that we've got quite a bit of the wind options available in the province. And to an extent we also have solar available to us. Now how the battery storage works is that you actually have a renewable component that is used to generate the energy. The battery storage is driven to the facility to be able to store that energy. So one of the requirements is in fact that you have the ability for renewable in the province. So that's the one part. The second part is our substation configuration for Western Cape met the requirement for the World Bank. So most of our substations were actually ready to be able to take on battery storage. Our environmental approvals were also in place, and that saved us quite a bit of time because the normal EIA process would take us anywhere between 18 months and 5 years. So that did make it a lot easier. So in phase 1, phase 2, Western Cape has been quite a bit in terms of the battery storage project. In total, Chair, we see the battery storage being able to hold about close to 350 megawatts of storage capacity. In context, that's 10% of the load of the Western Cape. If you have to look at it from a load shedding perspective, if we had battery storage, we could effectively manage stage one without load shedding in the Western Cape, if you just have battery storage. Because you require to offer 10% of stage one. The next question that was asked was really about electrification and what we're doing in the province around electrification, and specifically what are we doing about informal electrification in the province. So very briefly, Chair, our numbers over the last few years and our projected numbers over the next coming years is roughly between 7 and about 11,000 on average connections that we can begin over the next 5 years. The best we've ever done in this province is 20,000 connections. 50% of those are informal and the other 50% is formal. On the left of the slide are the districts, the system indication, and there are a lot of projects that actually come from those different areas. So we've got a breakdown of all the projects if you like. But I just thought I'd summarize and tell you, typically in the city of Cape Town we're going to do about just under 6,000 connections in this financial year. We see close to that in the next financial year, so the numbers are fairly stable in terms of what we can. But you will see that there's a slight decrease as we go along. And the reason for that decrease is that formal electrification is based on houses being placed. So the definition of formal electrification is that you need to have a house that is built that you need to electrify. If you don't have a house built, then it moves on formal to informal. And I'll show you on the next slide typically what we do on the informal side. On average, we're spending about between 85 and 100 million rand per year on electrification. This is Department of Energy funded electrification. There are also other projects, Chair, which are not included here, but they are quite small. Where, for instance, province is funded some of the electrification as well. And the city as well. So if we had to look at the split between formal and informal, Chair, if you just look at the current year, it's almost a 50-50 split between formal and informal. Now we've estimated in this province, we estimate there's about 200 informal settlements.
Checking with the question around local settlement, and I might want to just give a definition of what we have in the Eskom for local settlement. Local settlement is really a process in Eskom where we allow either a single customer or a group of customers over a 1 year period at minimum to have an incentive scheme where they save energy over that period. And when we have to load shed as Eskom, that we then take into consideration the fact that they have been on a settlement program. So what we do is we do based on studies before, have a look at what the average consumption is, we then agree with them that they need to save 10% of that over the year, and then we can exempt them to certain stages of load shedding. However, when we get to the stage 4s of load shedding check, some of these arrangements cannot be effective because of the size of the load that has to be shared. So in this province chair, what we have is we've got a settlement in place with Sylvana Steel. We have one with Fox. I've listed some of the bigger customers, but also to indicate where we don't load share. And we don't load share them for strategic reasons. If you look at Aspon Energy, which is the old Chevron, and Petro SA, we don't load share them because they are actually a supplier of fuel to Eskom. So we actually need them to load share. So there would be no point to share them. Because we won't have to deal with the OCGTs. We also have a national arrangement with Transnet, so it's not a provincial arrangement. We have a national level, Transnet access to service, and not at the provincial level. And then the one that we also knocked the tail is Transnet, and I think for really obvious reasons. The rail network is just too ingrained in the economy and also in the geography for us to be able to diversify. If we were to stop the train from going to Japan would be a much bigger problem than that. So we do not develop proper for that reason. And then what we do have with Somerset Maugham is also a development plan where they give us 10% of their nominated maximum demand over the 1 year period. And when we load check in stage one, what we do is we take 1 MVA of their load off. Stage So that's the carbon that I can produce based on the 10% saving over the year. And that's really all the carbon customers that we have in this province. All other customers are subjected to the more low-chain national machine. What we try to do is in economic areas, and a good example of that would be like the Montague area, we've gone and we've spoken to customers that are on the same network and asked the customers if they could not themselves agree how they would like to fail. Then we would look at replacing the entire network as opposed to one customer. It's very difficult if you have 10 customers on the same network to curtail one of the 10 customers. You actually need all 10 customers to agree to save, and we can measure that saving, and then we can curtail that particular network. I must say it doesn't always work because some customers are 24/7 customers with their operation, other customers are 9-5 and they don't always see the same network. But we are trying to encourage that with the economic drivers. Chairman, one of the questions that we were asked is the concept of Ankara, particularly the open cycle gas, the combined cycle gas turbines. So we have over the last few years, Chair, been talking about making the shift from open cycle to closed cycle and the benefits of that because it means that you also have your fuel options we can use. It also means that you can run those machines more than you would normally. But it also does with the shorter maintenance periods. What we can tell you, Chair, we've done the new fuel burners, they've been completed, they've been installed, and that is phase 1A. In phase 1B, we've concluded on some of the project activities in terms of finalizing the design, etc., to shift from open cycle to closed cycle. And in phase 2, Chair, what we're going to be doing is to actually complete the balance of the units that we need to change from open cycle to closed cycle. So we've done about 50% of those units already from the shift to closed cycle. We haven't yet shifted to a dual fuel option. I think the idea is obviously we'd like to get all the units completed and then move to that. Chair, the other one that we haven't covered here is Solico, which is also part of our peaking plant. Which are open cycle gas turbines sitting in the muscle way area. And we also use that as part of our peaking plant. So when we find that we have, we're not getting any peak, we run those plants. And those are the diesel plants, both of them are crew. And Chair, that's the summary of the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to open for questions on the provincial part of the presentation. I'm going to
thank you, Chair. Thanks for the presentation. I've got three questions to ask from the presenter. The first question is, you stated that the airport in the text, you guys are the top performer in the country. Can you please elaborate on what constitutes your good performance when you are faced with a lot of townships that are still not relative without electricity and also with little connections in terms of electrifying their households? Number two, you said also that the rate of electrification in your own assessment is very low. Can you also give us the reasons on those on that? And the last one is, you also mentioned the issue of these projects that you guys are having in the province for renewable energy. And what I want to know is what are the targeted areas for this project to be implemented?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I hope there will be multiple rounds of questions. My first one is just you've been pretty quiet on the cost of electricity. Cost of energy is obviously for us the bottom line. At one stage, many years ago, we were brought under the impression that Eskom is one of the most efficient producers of electricity in terms of the cost per unit. That situation has changed with some years where we've seen rate increases far exceeding the normal consumer price indexes, etc. So my first question is, where are we currently in terms of our electricity cost, and where would ESCOM like us to be, because we know that NASA has been blocking some of your applications for tariff increases. The second one is the role of Angela and Kovikwa. If you could give us an indication of currently, how often are they required to run and produce energy? And the reason why I'm asking that is obviously if they are going to be very seldom put to use, then the conversion to gas would not make economic sense. But should we find that they need to help us, let's say in the winter every evening, then obviously you know, the position changes. So perhaps you can just tell us, have you done studies? Obviously you must also project how much you intend to use that installation going forward. And would you perhaps be in a position to guarantee Portec or Transnet that you will make use of the gas line to, for example, Ankara for a minimum, you know, amount of time or minimum volume of gas, so that, you know, it becomes a viable option for Transnet to put in such a gas pipeline, and so that other industries hopefully would be able to plan for the future also making use of that line. So if you could just bring us up to speed as far as that's concerned. And then my third and last question for now is the cost of electricity. I always find a very interesting one, because there's the generation cost and there's the distribution cost. But even on the generation side, it's quite complicated, because if you generate electricity, it seems to be in peak hour, the cost per unit is so much more. And if you generate, you know, when the demand is low, perhaps like over weekends, on Saturday afternoon, I would presume, Sundays, that then you know, some of your more costly plants can be switched off, although not all plants, you know, can easily be up switched on and off again. So if you could just give us, if it's possible, a split between the generation costs of electricity and then the distribution costs. And the reason why I'm asking this is that, you know, quite often people say, I can produce energy far cheaper than what ESCOM is currently doing, but then they don't, you know, also think of the cost of distribution, which is a cost, you know, you can't avoid. Thank you, Chair.
Complete this project, chances are Western Cape will be in a trade where actually the concept or the issue of load shedding is not going to be that much of a burden. Did I hear it correctly? If you can maybe substantiate more on this. And then I just want to know, like the system between the two projects, you are mentioning maybe something different. Between the wind generation project, can you tell me what happened to the wind farm that has come? I'm not sure somewhere here in the Western Cape, you know, what happened to that project, and is it already providing electricity on time to the grid, and if so, what is the volume, you know, if it's already actually connected to the system. And then my last one, Chair, before the last one, educate me. I think you explained very well about the formal electrification. I didn't understand much the informal electrification. What does that mean? What does that concept mean? And is this load curtailment available to households? And I'm saying here at this point, let's say you're talking about those that are in the inter communities, that is the sectional titles and all of that, if that was only a process available to big companies, you know, and what's the process of, because I think it's a beautiful sort of strategy that will have incentivize those that are able to save electricity. And my last one, Chair, is whether since we're talking about no energy mix in South Africa for some time now, since we hit our challenge of electricity, do you guys have a sort of a cost analysis, you know, between electricity and all the different types? And I mean the IPPs at this point, because I think what I'm interested in is what is the cost competitiveness, you know, of IPPs, especially in terms of the type of tariff structure that we have currently in our
state.
create zero emission for the next 6 years. Why is that? And then also, you make a statement on page 37 where you say there's no formal electrification backlog in the Western Cape. What's your source where you got that information? And are you 100% sure that that is in fact correct? I'm not, let me just clarify, I'm not disputing that the information on the presentation. Just at my own reference, I just want to clarify that. Thank you. But again, I'm a thank you for the presentation.
Thank you. I'm going to now come to answer those questions first before I open for another round of questions.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think between myself and the CFO will respond to the question. The first question is how do we explain the performance versus some of the electric components problems? So the performance, the technical performance, and like I said, there's two metrics that we look at, and that is the number of times that customers get interrupted and for how long they get interrupted. I must also say we only measure that on customers that are registered on our system. So I'm not talking about customers that are supplied by the City of Cape Town or Dali, which are part of our municipality. Those are customers sitting in Eskom network that Eskom supplies, and we measure our performance for those customers. Now, if you look at people staying in formal settlements, some of them we have actually electrified, so we've given them escalators and they put that on our system and we measure them as part of their performance. The either component of let's say illegal customers that are sitting on the network, we're really aware of that, and the Eskom, I think our number is about 6% of that we attributed to losses. Part of that is split between technical and non-technical. The non-technical is typically where we have customers that are illegally connected. We try and encourage very much for those customers that are connected illegally. We go out there at least once a month and we sweep the area that are informal to look at those networks. Not very easy because we take down those illegal networks and within hours they back up. But we try and encourage those customers more from a safety perspective than anything else to get a legal meter. We have got a deviation in our number, but that deviation is less than 1% in terms of its accuracy. So when I say that the customers only experience no more than 20 hours, and that's on average, you might find a customer that has experienced 25 hours, but then you find a customer that only experienced 10 hours. So that's the average that we get. That's so our technical performance is really based on our customer base and how we're servicing that area. How we compare ourselves, given that they're still unidentified areas, you know, would that number be anywhere up or down? I think the performance in problems, and I might answer the other question at the same time, the performance in the problems is very much based on two things. One is that it's got to do with the investment that you make in the network, the design of that network, and also your ability to serve that customer. So if you're dispatching customers or you're dispatching operators to faults very quickly, then the duration of that customer is out to becomes really short. If you're taking hours and hours to dispatch them and they take several hours to fix the fault, then that customer experience goes from 1 hour to about 6-7 hours. And it depends on what level the fault is at. If the fault is at a household level, then it's an individual customer that you're dealing with. If it's at a much higher level where you've got 1,000 customers on a transformer and the transformer actually goes, that is the median calculated as 1,000 customers at 4 hours. It's 4,000 hours lost. So for us it's quite important that we have faults at a what we call an envy level, that we deal with those very quickly because the customer numbers are quite big. But the defining factor is your response to the fault, that's your network reliability and investment both in maintenance. I think we see the benefits in those problems of good decisions that made over the last 10 years or so, where we built good, strong networks. We have had challenges over the last 2 years. I think we've had unprecedented storms and rain in this province. But the networks have, for the most part, withstood those. The challenge is definitely on the informal environment, where we still have to electrify people, whether they're living in a shack, whether they're living in a windy house, or whatever. As long as they're not in a formalized house, they're considered to be informal. The reason why electrification rate, particularly for the informal areas, are so low, electrification is actually for the identification of the areas for electrification is actually a municipal competence. So the municipality identifies the area it wants electrified. It then sends a list to ESCOM. We then submit that list to the Department of Minerals and Energy for funding. So we actually only act on the instruction of the municipality in terms of which areas and how many connections are there identified. We do assist because we go into areas and we see areas that we believe still need to be electrified and we go back to the municipality. So we engage with the municipality on a quarterly basis to make sure that we can reconcile what they found and what we found in terms of what was being electrified. But ESCOM doesn't identify the areas for electrification. It is actually a municipal competence and it is a process that exists between ESCOM and municipalities as to how we do that. So we present numbers once a year. We contract with the Department of Minerals and Energy for those numbers. And we get an opportunity once a year to adjust those numbers, which is in September of each year. We then approach municipalities prior to September to say, we see that this housing development is not getting up in the area. The money is being allocated. We see an area that can be electrified quite quickly. Would you consider then to swap those areas out so we can get people electrified? So our guide is really try not to give the money back. We'd rather find alternative connections in the province and try and make sure that no matter what happens, that we electrify someone in the province with the money that is allocated. But it is a confirmation of our relationship with the municipality and then obviously identifying those areas that need to be electrified. The details around the areas that we've highlighted for renewable energy. I think if you look at the ones in the pilot in phase one, there's only one in the Eastern Cape market and the other one is what we call Scarfield. And Scarfield is right next to our series of offices in Rotterdam. Some of the criteria identified by the World Bank for the sites is that they wanted the sites to, one, be close to an area that actually has an option for renewable. So if you look at Hopefield, it's where the wind farm is, so it's been identified as an area that for renewable energy wind is quite out there. So what the World Bank wanted is they wanted us to link these projects to the renewable areas in the public time. And this is also the reason why the Western Cape in phase one has benefited quite a bit, because if you even look at the national grant for renewable energy, there's a significant portion allocated to the Western Cape. And it is because of the fact that we have wind and we have solar in the province. And you find that there's very little allocated to some of the inland provinces because they don't really have an option for wind, etc. So that was one of the criteria from the World Bank. The other criteria is that you need to have existing infrastructure that would be able to actually take that up. And so we went through an exercise in the country to identify the areas firstly and then the infrastructure that is able to cope with that. So in this province, again, we were fortunate in that our infrastructure has been able to cope. And that was one of the criteria as well. What we've added is SM to say, can we also then look at linking that to a constrained network? And this is why I use the written book here, this here as an example. It is currently a constrained network. Will us bring it in the battery storage or actually open up that network for us and allow the economy to grow? So we've added that as one of the criteria we'd like to use. But that's the reason why we've benefited from this. And those are the areas that has been identified on the basis of renewable energy space, infrastructure that's able to cope with it, and we were able to unlock some of the contract networks. And that's really the country that we use. Okay, the fourth question really about the cost and just where are we currently and maybe an indication of what our projection is in terms regulators when it's clear that government is not palatable. Our submission to the regulator is very much based on a cost-effective value. And I think the difficulty that we face with this ESCOM is that in previous years it was a subsidized cost, and it was not cost-effective, in fact for many years. But it was done for a particular reason. We wanted to incentivize foreign investment and other investment in the country. So we had free customers coming in, we had a subsidy mechanism in place across the country, and so the rate of electricity or the price of electricity was made very affordable to encourage this investment. I think over the last few years we've seen that that subsidy mechanism has been withdrawn, and in particular, you know, we've now been asked to put on the table what it costs us to produce energy. I think over the last 10 years that number has more than doubled. But what we try to reflect and be transparent about is what the actual cost to produce this energy. We know that there's a host of factors that we need to work on against it, and I think the big issue that everybody always thinks to us about is the cost of primary energy, what you cut through your coal synthesis. And there's been lots of effort put into trying to manage that relationship with the coal supply vendors and the mines to get the best possible price for this. We also renegotiated a number of contracts to make sure that they, the best interests of the country as opposed to the mines. But it is about cost effective strategy.
Thank you, Olivier. I think you've said basically perfectly important things. We sincerely believe that our tariffs are not cost effective. And we are in negotiation with NERSA, with the regulator, to deal with these issues. If you compare our cost at this point in time and to the rest of the world, you will see that we are still extremely competitive. So I'll just leave it there for the time being. I'd like to jump over to the second question, and that was the issue on Ankara and Haribo. We designed and we implemented those two open-cycle gas turbine projects as emergencies. However, we're not using it as emergencies. And it's important to give you just a few facts. Whenever you run one of these open cycle gas turbines, per unit we are burning 14 liters of diesel a second. If you times it by 60 and 50 rand per liter, then you see an entire week per unit we're spending 750,000, $750,000, $750,000, just by burning one of these. So we had projected in the beginning of the year based on our system performance, generation system performance, 400 mils of diesel for the year. However, I don't know if you can recall, we had a winter plan in Eskom where we said there is a possibility that during winter, we may be running the risk of at least 26 days of load shedding, say one. With dedication and hard work, our generation colleagues within the organization averted all of this. And we spent quite a lot less, significantly less diesel than what we had forecasted in the beginning of the winter. We are now in summer, we've got a summer plan. Are we out of the woods? Is load shedding something of the past? No, it's not. The risk remains. And maybe it's good that I just spend a little bit of time on our system performance, although the question was not asked, but if you don't mind, I can give it the next question that I can deal with it. I always use my own body as an example. The older you get, the more often you need to look at the body. It's just a fact of life. And when you pick up something, you need to do something about it, because if you don't do something about it, then you're going to pick up problems. Now, Eskom's average fleet age, the coal fleet, is 37 years old. So there's another 13, 15 years before we could have exceeded. So when we identified, well, let me first of all look at the bodies. Enough? No, we haven't. And when we picked up something, that we do something about it? No, we have not. I'd like to use another example just to demonstrate. It's like an old car. You have a car that is 12, 15 years old. And whenever you get in the car and you put it on the accelerator and it's just all the way down from point A to point B, and when you stop, you get out. So when you're back in the car, you do exactly the same. And when you stop one time, you look under the car, there's a little water. If you open the bonnet, you see, okay, there's a little bit of a leak in the pipe between the engine block and the radiator. And you don't replace the pipe. You take PVC tape and you fix it. So this is the way we did the job plant, and this is where we are currently today. It's going to take years. It's going to take a few years to get to the stage where we can say our plant is reliable and we can predict how it's going to perform. So up until that stage, we will be making use of our emergency reserves. So we should open cycle gas turbines are one of them, and then obviously our pump storage. So we do have a forecast. I don't like to use a budget for diesel, because how do you budget to burn diesel? So, but we have a forecast that we may require in terms of expenditure. But I can put on the table that it is significantly less than what we predicted right from the beginning. And per month, we know exactly what we will need, where it may happen. If you take in summer, which is now nearly 6 weeks, have we had tough times? Yes, we have. I wouldn't say we were close to load shedding, but there were days that we had to burn quite a few of these diesels. But one day I can recall we burned 10 of the 14 that we had, which is not desirable, and with our financial situation, we don't want to do that. So I'd just like to put that on the table. So then the Transnet gas line, the GM has earlier said that we are looking to convert these open cycles to combined cycle, which will then be, you can use it at a sort of baseline, and that it's also cheaper to run, and that you can use a cheaper input cost, which is gas. So our project development section is currently in the process to source the primary energy gas. So that mandate has been given to them, and it has not been concluded. So I believe, talking from here, if there is a reliable supply of primary energy gas, then obviously it's going to make it look, you know, people as much cheaper than burning diesel. Jumping over to the cost of electricity, you asked a question on the value chain. Now the value chain is you need a generator to generate electrons, and then you need a wire system network to take the wires up the electrons over the wires to the customer. Use of electricity. Now, the generation component, I would guess, is about 70% of the cost, which is expensive, of which the primary energy is 60% of that 70%. Not 60 of the 70, but 60. If you say 70 is 100%, 60% of that is primary energy, which is coal. I had a look at the figure the other day. 10 years ago, we paid 180 rand, less than 180 rand per ton for coal. Currently, we spend 184 rand just on transport for a ton of coal. So, for whatever reason, the last couple of years of the effect in Eskom, where we moved away from a proven methodology that whenever you want to build a power station, you find the coal first. For 50 years it's available, then you build a power station next to it. We decided for some reason away from that for various reasons. I'm not going to go into that. And because of that, our input costs have escalated tremendously. I think that hopefully dealing with the issue of cost, electricity, probably I'm just going to deal with some of the other issues. The Sierra wind farm, the question was, is it in operation? Yes, it is. At Pukenham, it's 100 megawatts. And it is generating the battery storage location, and you can deal with that issue. Then IPPs, there was a question of IPP costs. It is a big debate, even within Eskom. The Department of Energy is entering into power purchase agreements with the independent power producers, and then Eskom need to buy it at whatever cost. And the difference between what we're selling electricity and what we have to buy from the IPPs, we can then recoup by means that have from the regulator. So what I can put on the table is, if you look at from the first IPP that has been constructed, the reduction in cost, and we believe South Africa needs to have the benefit of this experience in cost that has been reduced, and I believe that the departments will enter into some negotiations with IPPs in time. But there is quite a significant difference in what we have to buy and what we are selling. And that difference is by means of the tariff that we do, although there are some challenges between this and the regulator in terms of that, and there's four cases that will be coming soon, but the public, the general public, is paying for that difference between what they are selling for and what we are buying for and what we sell.
Thank you. And just to clarify the question around the battery storage project and the common property, I was just trying to draw a comparison between what we're able to actually produce in battery storage is equivalent to what would be required in the stage foundation for those problems. It's not that the one will offset the other, but let me clarify that. It's just that the capacity of battery storage is in fact quite good. And as technology, I think, evolves and gets better and better, the units will become smaller and smaller, and I think over time, obviously, more cost effective as well. But I can give you a good example of where we've run a pilot in the Western Cape. It's in our line up here, in the front of Washington. We've taken a cross cut of ISM, so higher end ISM, and also people at the lower end of the ISM, and reinvent that network. And for the last year, we've run a pilot there on that research at a much smaller capacity than the utility plant. And what we've been testing there are two things. Very one, is it able for us, are we able to actually manage that network using that storage? That's the one. Is there potential to do energy trading amongst the customers in that area? And what we have found, so when we were load shedding in the country, Rhinop was one of the areas that never got load shed because they had battery storage. So we fitted every household in that area with the PV. So it's very much a smaller scale we've been doing for the whole bank. That we're just piloting it, just to iron out some of the issues, iron out some of the system challenges we might have, and what type of meeting we need, because you need a type of meter that is able to both receive and send data to you. What we found in that area is that the customers started to actually trade on the energy. So the lower allocated customers were generating quite a bit of energy but didn't need it. Were able to trade them for the higher allocated customers who had more things that they needed energy for. And so we started to see this trading relationship happening in the lineup provider. What we also noted is that this actually also started in a period where we had dark and cable. And the reverse was taking place. The higher allocated customers had more water than they needed. Then the lower allocated. And they were able to trade their water for energy. So it seems as if the pilot, and we've got another young pilot with our research colleagues, who we want to just iron out some of the issues and see how it works. But it seems like it's possible for us to install the system at that scale. So it's possible for you to use that storage to offset some of the issues that we have. Like I said, Bart is one of those units. But he really must take it back.
The other question that we needed to respond to was how do we define informal electrification? So formal electrification is defined as an urban that we proclaim and that the hub is going to be built in that area within the next few years on that property. We can, in the interim, actually electrify the urban by using a meter, even if that customer decides for the first 2 years and then put the ready out there. As long as it's been proclaimed, the urban, and that hub is being presented in our own, it's considered to be formal. So informal is actually any area that is unproclaimed, and there is no planning in the next 3 years to build in that area. That is considered to be informal. Whether that be a backyard rather, or whether that be an actual informal settlement where we have shops. And that's how we define. And I'm not out of this here. This is our department of the energy defines for the informal. The other question around the local planning for small users. At the moment, the system is very geared towards big users because they have the least impact. Also, it is based on the network configuration.
So if you look at customers as a household, you could have thousands of customers on one network. So when we look at saving, we're looking at saving at the network level, not so much at the household. So you would need, you know, an entire gated community to agree to save 10%, and then you have to measure each household in terms of their consumption. Most of our large power users are still on conventional metering, so we don't have to pay for them. So what we can do is we can take estimates and reads of what they've done in the last year, and then we can ask for 10% reduction of it. Most of the small power users as problems are prepaid. It's really difficult for us to see how much they're actually consuming because the unit can stay on that meter for quite long. So at the moment the curtailment program is not geared for smaller customers. It's probably something that we should look at, but it is quite difficult to manage on a network level, but not impossible. The question from the other committee member was about in the NDP we talk about the Karoo, but we don't specify which area. I think maybe just for clarity, we have projects in the Karoo. In fact, we've got two, and that makes up the 6 million that we've allocated, but at least for an IPP in that area. So it's not for the Karoo itself, but it's actually to strengthen our network for that IPP that's coming into the Karoo. So I think maybe related to that is, you know, how would the Karoo really benefit from that? What you will find is that we do the upstream strengthening for the IPP, so we will effectively make sure that there's bigger transformers in place. So when we connect the IPP, that we have practically distributed that energy. The benefit is obviously the reliability that goes with that for that area, improved reliability for that area. But we can give specifics around what site it is that we're looking at, and that might be sufficient. Jim can also email that info. And then breakdown maintenance for certain areas are not necessarily indicated which areas the maintenance is allocated for. I think that was the next question. Again, Chair, we can specify which areas we've allocated in terms of where we can do breakdown maintenance. The next question was around the actual cost, the actual money spent year to date versus the budget, and it's the gap we closed the 2 year ago. Check the maintenance is planned in planned reverse. So what we do is we actually have works orders that we have allocated to certain parts of the year. So we would not, for instance, do vegetation management in the winter. So we would do vegetation management just before the summer season starts, so we avoid fires. So we won't do it too far ahead of the fire season. So what we've done is we've actually programmed our maintenance so it takes place at certain parts of the year. I can give the committee comfort that this province has never not spent its maintenance. Never. In fact, we've overspent 35% of our maintenance, so we go fat up with maintenance. But it is programmed in the year for us. The other thing that we do is what we call opportunity maintenance. If a project is in an area doing work, so if that customer is going to be affected because you've got an artificial project, we go in at the same time and do maintenance there as well. So we do what we call opportunity maintenance as well. We're going to have an IP to go in there and do the substation maintenance at the same time. Chair, then the question was, do we think that the 5 year maintenance agreement with the World Bank on the West Project is that adequate to do the skills transfer? I think it is adequate. It also gives us an opportunity, one, to learn the technology, two, to make sure that the screens for that technology actually come into the ESCOM SAC system, because at the moment those are not registered items on our SAC system, so we would not be able to place components we didn't know how to do it. So it will give us a chance to get those screens into our system, but it's more than sufficient time for our operators to understand how to maintain the batteries. The network leading to and from the battery stores, that's normal network for us. It's really just a matter of understanding how to maintain the batteries, how to dispose of those batteries, and how to take your work in that space with the batteries. So I think the 5 years is more than adequate. And then the question was, in the Karoo, the zero electrification connection is projected. And the NHA is an indication of what the municipality is actually put through the ESCOM. So if the municipality in the area does not identify electrification for the area, then we don't necessarily have a view of that.
I do want to say that we do do our own investigations, and we do go to the municipality, and we will take it that we see that there's an informal area. You know, I must also qualify and say that a municipality won't necessarily want us to electrify an area if they can't provide other basic services to that same area. Because their concern is we give them electricity, but there's no water and no sanitation. So it's always that when we're going to go into electrification, we want to give the other basic services as well. But we do indicate to municipalities where we find areas, especially informal areas, where we think we can electrify. They then come back to us and say that or not they are happy to do it. And then those numbers get into our data numbers. And then is our data accurate when it says that there's no formal backlog?
As well as the national policy.